had Philip, you bald head, when he looked behind him and saw them, he cursed them in the name of Yahweh. And two female beggars came out of the woods and tore up 42 youths of their number. And he went from there to Mount Carmel, and from there he returned to the city of Samaria. All right. So, of course, a lot of people would cite this story as a just one of these grotesque, morally abominable stories in the Old Testament, which is interesting after, you know, 3,000 years or so, that it's only now in our modern sensibilities we know to be offended by this story. It suggests that, you know, we just don't share the same perspective nowadays, or at least some people don't, the properly accepted perspective. But it also has to do with the caricature that's made, that these are, you know, 2 and 3-year-olds, you know, just out in the street playing, having a good time, and say something they think's funny about an old man or something. And, you know, and then this vindictive, hateful God of the Old Testament unleashes these horrifying bears just to kill them for no good reason. Well, if we look at it a little more rationally, I think we can appreciate, of course, the point of the story and the overall story about Elisha and Elijah is to underscore a very important point that the people needed to hear. And we've often observed that by the time the original readers read Samuel and Kings, of course, they've already been carried off into captivity. And so that's the lens, the experience through which they're going to go back and reread this history and see foreshadowed in that history many of the causes of why they find themselves where they are. And so if you look in 2 Chronicles chapter 36, of course, this is the last chapter of 2 Chronicles. It is, in fact, in the Hebrew Bible, the last chapter of all. And this kind of is an effort of the writer to sum up the situation that they find themselves in. And so picking up in verse 15, Yahweh, God of their father, sent word to them again and again by his messengers because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place, but they continually mocked the messengers of God, despised his words, scoffed at his prophets, until the wrath of Yahweh arose against his people until there was no remedy. And if you think some bears coming is a judgment, how about the entire might of the Babylonian army under Nebuchadnezzar, where the nation is destroyed, the city of Jerusalem is destroyed, the temple is destroyed, and so on. And so you can see one of the things that is singled out there, the cause of the destruction of the nation, you mock the prophets of God. And that's what's going on in this story. And we're told it was done by some young men. These are not 2-year-olds. You remember the story of Absalom. Absalom is described by the same word. And Absalom's old enough to stage a revolt against his father and take over as king and all of that. So we're not dealing with little children here. We're dealing with men, young men. And their attitude they have is probably directed against Elisha because he's a prophet. I don't think this is just a chance encounter where they decide to have some fun at some guy's expense. But this idea of go up and go up, you know, that hints, I couldn't prove this conclusively, but it hints at Elisha in his official capacity as a prophet of God. You know, you're the inheritor of Elijah. You know, prove yourself. You know, do you really have what it takes? And calling him a bald head, it seems highly unlikely that it's because he actually was bald. Now, it could be the case that he was. But, you know, most people at this time, when they're traveling around, they're under their head covered with a cloak anyway. And so unless they just happen to know him or had seen his driver's license at some point or something and knew he was bald, how would they even know he was bald? And that might suggest that their reference to him having a bald head is more a you know, figurative statement, as if you know, you have no cover, you know, and would be another way of saying you're not a true prophet, you know, something of that nature. So it is to be understood as a mockery of Elisha, and his bestowal of a curse in the name of the Lord, which is not just I'm going to curse you, and the power I'm using is the Lord, but because their mockery ultimately is against the Lord and offends the Lord, and then the judgment befalls them. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean Elisha is the one to conjure up the judgment. Ultimately, God is the one who sends these bears, and we find out at least there were 42 of them that fall prey to this judgment. So, the picture I get is kind of a large gang of thugs and mockers of the true prophet of Israel, and so they pretty much get what they deserve. That's a completely different story, man. Some little kids, you know, playing a game, and, you know, the prophet then gets funny and takes his, you know, anger out.
It is worth noting, I think, that Leviticus, in the punishment for disobedience, right, and this is Leviticus 26, right after God gets done talking about a drought and famine, basically, making the heavens like iron and earth like bronze, which is exactly what we saw at the end of 1 Kings, he says, if you continue to walk contrary to me, I will let loose wild beasts against you, which shall bereave you of your children and destroy your livestock. So there is a specific reference in the punishment to wild beasts killing their children directly after drought and famine.
Right. And also, there's a provision made in the law for the, you know, those who mock God's prophets are mocking God, and they already put to death. So, like you said, there's precedent for that.
Could this be part of including 23 through 25, establishing, in a sense, the power that Elisha has and the true fact that he is a prophet of God? Because it's very similar to what Moses did. So he parts the river, then he makes the water drinkable, and then he basically curses them, you know, Moses cursed Pharaoh, and animals respond, and, you know, in that action.
Right. Well, we certainly get a sequence of stories here to, you know, do two things. It builds Elisha's credibility as a prophet, particularly as a successor to Elijah, and also those who, you know, fall afoul of the true prophets like Elijah and Elisha will not fare well, and you know, judgment is going to be a result. And then also what we're going to see in this series of stories is how God manifests himself, and here it's judgment against the unbelievers, the wicked, and in other ways, God caring for the widow and the orphan, and that kind of thing that we see here as well. But in that sense, yeah, absolutely, that Spirit of God is with Elisha, and he possesses that power and authority as God's true prophet.
And another thing, could it also be that he's kind of using this as a type to point back to Moses, because Moses parted the Red Sea and the water turned bitter because of the golden calf. So this whole idolatry, Elisha fighting idolatry, this whole symbolism to point back to, you really need to go back to the law. As Moses would try to move down
right. Yeah, and we've talked about a lot of these connections with Moses and Elijah, and Elijah and Elisha, the theme of fire, and things like that. So, certainly with the parting of the Jordan, in you know, very much imitation of Joshua as the successor of Moses, and he parted the Jordan like Moses parted the Red Sea. So, you definitely have a lot of those kind of things going on here. You don't have a bear story with Moses or Elijah specifically, obviously.
You have to bear with the people for 40 years.
Yeah, to bear with the people for 40 years. 42 years? Okay. All right, we're moving on now to chapter 3. So Jehoram, son of Ahab, became king over Israel at Samaria, which again here is a city, third and last king capital of the kingdom of the north. In the 18th year, Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, reigned 12 years. We've already talked about this chronological reference. It's different from the one given in chapter 1, but that's because you had these co-regencies going on with like Jehoshaphat and his son ruling at the same time. And Jehoram's reign in the north is correlated with both of those kings of Judah. He did evil in the sight of Yahweh, though not like his father and his mother, not quite as bad as Jezebel and Ahab. For he put away the sacred pillar of Baal which his father had made. Nevertheless, he clung to the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel sin, and he did not depart from them. So that, in the end, is really the summation of Jehoram. Now, we're going to have a lot said about Elisha and the king of Israel that throughout this section is going to be Jehoram until Jehu's purge, even if the king's not named, it's going to be this son of Ahab, Jehoram. You remember after Ahab died, his brother had first succeeded the throne, but he's the one that fell out the window and didn't have any heirs, and so his brother then becomes the king in his place. So this story, in the first 12 verses, Moab revolts against Israel. And remember, this had really been mentioned in the very first verse of 2 Kings. Moab rebelled against Israel after the death of Ahab. That doesn't necessarily mean we've got two revolts, or there's a precise chronological statement being given exactly when this happened. But we're now going to give them some information about the unfolding of the revolt. It's basically, the point is, it's after Ahab, who was clearly a very powerful and strong king, he's out of the picture. Moab is emboldened to revolt, and they do so. And Jehoram is going to get Jehoshaphat to form an alliance and go try to subjugate the Moabites. So, verse 4, Mesha, king of Moab, was a sheep breeder, so that seemed to be their primary, gross national product kind of thing, and used to pay the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and the wool of 100,000 rams, and that doesn't seem to be a one-time tribute. That's apparently annually what he was on the hook for, and it came about when Ahab died and king of Moab rebelled, and so King Jehoram went out of Samaria at that time and mustered all Israel, sent word to Jehoshaphat, saying, "The king of Moab has rebelled against me. Will you go with me to fight against Moab?" And he said, "I will go up. I am as you are, my people as your people, my horses as your horses." Not quite as noble sounding as Ruth and Naomi, my people are your people. And he said, "Which way shall we go up?" And he answered, "The way of the wilderness of Edom." And so basically what they concluded is, we want to attack Moab, but we don't want to go through the territory of Ammon. That would be more heavily fortified. If we go down to Judah and Edom, and Edom at this time is a subsidiary of Judah, subjected vassal state. So they're going to have the Edomites with the people of Judah and Israel all together to go fight the Moabites. And so they're going to kind of come from the wilderness the less well-defended way. And so the king of Israel, the king of Judah, the king of Edom, they made a circuit of 7 days' journey. There was no water for the army or for the cattle that followed them. Now, what does that sound like? Immediately you read about some kind of drought or lack of water with Elisha here, the time of Elisha. Elisha's not appeared on the scene yet. But what does this make you think of?
The Israelites.
Okay, well, the wilderness not having water, and God will provide water.
So that sounds like poor military strategy.
Okay, a poor military strategy. It may not have been a natural or a supernatural drought or anything. Maybe it's gone in the wrong place or there wasn't any water.
Well, maybe Ahab, when the drought was there because of their sin, and so might be hinted at
connection between Elijah's stories and Elisha's stories, and there was a prominent drought of judgment for 3.5 years in Elijah's day, and that was with Ahab, of course, and his shenanigans. So now here's a similar kind of, you know, I guess we can take it, and certainly the favor of the Lord is not with them, and in fact they can't find any water. And it's interesting the kind of responses to this. Jehoram, the king of Israel, verse 10 says, "Alas, Yahweh has called these three kings to give them into the hand of Moab." So he reads the situation and says, "We're doomed. We're going to be weakened and vulnerable to the Moabites, and we're going to die." So Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, says, "Is there not a prophet of Yahweh here that we may inquire of Yahweh by him?" One of the king of Israel's servants answered and said, "Elisha, the son of Shaphat, is here, who used to pour water on the hands of Elijah." Which, we didn't know what's important about that, but that's, he was the servant of Elijah. And so Joshua said, "The word of Yahweh is with him." And so the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat and the king of Edom went down to him. And it's interesting, it doesn't say king of Israel, king of Judah, king of Edom. It names Jehoshaphat. Now this is another one of those alliances that probably wasn't the smartest thing for Jehoshaphat to do. He made an alliance with Ahab, he made an alliance with Ahab's first son, Ahaziah, and made an alliance now with Ahab's second son, and all of these were bad. Politics makes for strange bedfellows. Situation Jehoshaphat shouldn't have been himself in. And we've talked about this before with Jehoshaphat, a good king, but not very wise. And as a result, you know, all of his children except one dies, all of his grandkids except one dies, all of his great grandkids except one dies. So this kind of multi generational effect of his foolishness. It'd be great if we could pass our goodness down as effectively as our foolishness, but so be it. So, and they're going to consult Elisha, but Elisha doesn't come to them. They have to come to Elisha. And he says to the king of Israel, "What do I have to do with you?" You know, this idiot, what to be with you? Same thing Jesus says to his mother in John 2. Yeah. Our business interests don't intersect here. You've got your thing, I've got my thing. Sometimes it can be a very hostile type of attitude. That seems to be more the case here with Elisha. "Go to the prophets of your father, to the prophets of your mother." Again, Ahab and Jezebel, particularly where she was a worshiper of Baal. "And the king of Israel said to him, 'No, for Yahweh has called these three kings together to give them into the hand of Moab.'" And so it's all about a Yahweh thing here, he's claiming. And so Elisha says, "You want to talk about Yahweh? As Yahweh of hosts lives before whom I stand, were it not that I regard the presence of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, I would not look at you or see you, I wouldn't give you the time of day. Now bring me a minstrel." And it came about when the minstrel played, the hand of Yahweh came upon him, and then he gives the prediction, the prophecy of what's going to happen. Verse 15, you have this interesting little detail about calling for the, guy to play a harp or something. Any ideas about that? Don't know what to make of it whatsoever, let's be honest. So,
I guess the only thing I wonder is if maybe it was an accommodation for the king of Edom or something.
Yeah, and I wonder that too, or Israel, that this is a mechanism of some kind that might help them to trust in the oracle or whatever it was. Maybe if you like them to go to the movies, there's always a background music. I don't know. The interesting, it depends on what the tune was, It's like the whenever Darth Vader shows up, some phenomenal sound. And maybe with the harp with the change of notes along with the oracle. But in verse 16, we find this instruction: "Make this valley full of trenches, big trenches everywhere. For thus says Yahweh, you will not see wind or rain, Yet the valley will be filled with water, so you will drink, you, your cattle, and your beasts. This is but a slight thing in the sight of Yahweh. He will also give the Moabites into your hand. Then you will strike every fortified city, every choice city, fell every good tree, stop all springs of water, mar every good piece of land with stones. And sure enough, it happened in the morning, about the time of the offering of the morning sacrifice. Water came by the way of Edom. The country was filled with water. And so the first part of the prophecy was filled, and water is abundantly provided. So God is taking care of them. Again, not so much on behalf of Jehoram as Jehoshaphat, apparently. And then this leads us to the next part of the story, the actual outcome of the battle, what's going to happen. And so, the short of it is, they look out, the Moabites look out, and see all this red water everywhere. And it would be easy to be red, because in the morning sun tends to be red. And all the red rocks in this area are red. And so all that reflecting in the water would make it look really red. And they say, it's blood! The kings have surely fought together, and they have slain one another. And therefore, Moab will be spoiled. I don't know how many people have to die and make that much blood just flowing everywhere. But it would be a bloodbath, that's for sure. So, so they rush out to attack what they think is the remnants, clean up a few stragglers here and there. But of course, the Israelites turn the tables on them and smite the Moabites, slaughtering them. They destroyed their cities. Chop down all the good trees, stop up all the springs of water, all the things that Elisha said. Till Kir Hareseth had only its stones, however the slingers went about and struck it. And that's how stone fortifications would be reduced in the ancient world. We have these slingers with these tennis ball-sized rocks that they can hurl about 100 miles an hour, and they can do some real damage, not just against people, but fortifications. And when the king of Moab saw the battle was too fierce for him, he took with him 700 men and drew swords to break through to the king of Edom, but they could not. So he took his oldest son, who was to reign in his place, offered him as a burnt offering on the wall. And there came great wrath against Israel, and they departed from him and returned to their own land. And verse 27 is occasioned no end of debate and wonder about what's going on here. Well, it doesn't specify, first of all, whose wrath it is. Is this the wrath of God? Why is Israel to be blamed for what this Moabite king does in pagan worship of his deity? Other than it was Jehoram's idea to begin with, he didn't leave well enough alone. And the Moabites rebelling against Israel was probably part of the judgment of God against Israel because of the family of Ahab and Jezebel and all that. But Elisha is the one that predicted this victory and how they were to slaughter their enemies and all of that. So it's just difficult to see the Lord's wrath being involved in the situation.
Is there a rebuttal to Jordan's statement in verse 13, the war goes for these three kings together? It seems odd that we consider this a bad relationship, but Elisha never says the Lord has not brought us together in blood.
Right. But I think the statement, which is, I wouldn't give you the time of day if it wasn't for Jehoshaphat. So I'm only going to bless this enterprise because Jehoshaphat's a part of it. I think that's the implication to me, that Israel brings nothing to the table in terms of security. So the idea that God's bringing them together in a wonderful, godly action to do the will of God, that doesn't seem to be my first choice.
That would seem to be a failure. Yet, verse 18, Elisha says that God will deliver the Moabites into their hands.
Right. And, but they pretty much do rampage across the whole country. And they've attacked everything, destroyed everything, right up to their capital city that's left in the far south. And presumably that's where, you know, the king is making his final stand and with offering his son. What is clear is that the armies withdraw, and so they forfeit the total victory that they would have had otherwise. And the question, of course, is why did they do that? And some would suggest, well, of course, the god of Moabites is the one that was wrathful and prevailed in this case, and so Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, was successful in, you know, fending off the might of the combined armies of Israel, Judah, and Edom. Maybe it's the people that were wrathful. They said, whoa, what have we gotten ourselves into? We didn't sign up for this. This is horrifying. With the loss of the broad support of the regular army, you know, the foot soldiers, there was no point proceeding. Is it the Judeans that are wrathful? And they said, oh, what have we done making this alliance with Israel? Because it says wrath is against Israel, which typically would be read as Israel versus Judah, as the northern kingdom, not just God's people in general. And then another way that some look at it is the Moabites were emboldened to be, you know, more to fight with greater strength, or, you know, go berserk or something, and so with this renewed strength they had, they were able to fight off Israel or something. But the impression I get is that, you know, the superior army is withdrawing because they don't have a heart left to, you know, fight the thing out. But yeah, I don't know. It's one of those peculiar things.
Could it be that brethren from Judah were angered against Israel because of the human sacrifice in the pagan garden?
Yeah, but that would be one option of that. Some would even read this, they departed from him, meaning Jehoram. You know, the Judeans turned away in their alliance with the Edomites and left Israel alone. But I think probably the most natural way of reading that is they left the king of Moab. If you keep in mind, really the focus of this whole section is on Elisha. This is really just a side detail of the story, and it's a contrast between the prophecy that Elisha gives and what the people do, so to speak. And again, it doesn't seem that there was a failure on God's part in the making of the prophecy and the opportunity of victory that he offered and so on, as much as it was a failure to carry through on the part of the people. That's my best way to read it.
I do wonder, too, with verse 27. I mean, when it says they departed, it's hard to think that only the army of Israel departed and the others didn't. But the way it's written, the emphasis seems to be on the departure of Israel. The focus is on Israel in some way. I guess I wonder if part of the point is, you know, Ahab's son is depicted as not trusting in God at all. He says, oh, God just brought us here to die. That's how much I think of God. God says, well, I don't think anything of you. I'm only going to do something to the king of Judah. And then you get here to the end, and the last word about Israel is that they wind up turning around. And I wonder if the narrator is trying to make a point about just how, you know, putting them in a bad light.
Yeah, I think we probably can't know for sure, but sound to me, just what maybe is it possible that they kept in the city, the capital city, and they, you know, besieged it. The king offers his son as an offering to the Israelites. And so it kills him, and they accept it and say, okay, now you'll start paying tribute again, but God had told them to destroy the city. And so God had a great wrath on them because they accepted, you know, kind of like only striking the arrows three times.
Right. Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it. If this was a down payment on some kind of covenant treaty with Israel to, break off or something like that. I never really thought about it, though. I'll have to mull it over.
This is one of the kings that his record exists in from Mark 11, right?
Yeah, this is the Mesha Sela character, Moabite stone guy.
Does it mention this particular event at all?
Well, I don't think it mentions about,
I mean, if they did that regularly, that was part of their religion, I thought it might have mentioned it. I did this, and then the tides turned in our favor.
It certainly gives a very favorable view of Chemosh giving them deliverance from their enemies, that kind of thing. And that's the idea of offering a human sacrifice. It's like, this is the most valuable thing I have, so I'm going to give it to my God, and whatever virility, strength, power of youth and that kind of thing is somehow mystically going to be imparted to oneself or one's army, that kind of thing. But boy, it's really hard for us to wrap our minds around. We'd much rather sacrifice our children to television and bad movies and things like that. It's less painful, but just as deadly, unfortunately. So anything else? Chapter 3 here. All right, chapter 4, now for something a little bit different. Elisha again appears on the scene more front and center, so to speak. He's kind of almost a side note, so to speak, at least the way the story was unfolded in the battle with Moab. He's not on the front lines, holding up his hands to give the forces of Israel the advantage over the enemies or anything like that, playing over. Here in the first 7 verses, we have a widow, one of the prophets. She says, "Your servant, my husband, is dead. You know that your servant feared Yahweh. The creditor has come to take my 2 children to be his slaves." This is a pretty common practice of slavery to pay off the debt. Of course, the law provided there was a limit to that. Every 7 years, they had to be released from this form of slavery. And Elisha said, "What shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in the house?" And she said, "Your maidservant has nothing in the house except a jar of oil." And apparently this is a flask of oil. And so he tells her, "Go borrow every container you can, get your hands on, go inside, shut the door." And she keeps pouring oil out of this flask until there are no more containers, and then the oil finally stops. And she came and told the man of God, and he said, "Go sell the oil, pay your debt, you and your sons can live on the rest." There was an abundance, more than enough to pay the debt and also to live on. Well, this is, of course, very similar to the story of Elijah, right? Where he asks the widow to prepare him some food, and she just has a little bit of meal and grain and oil, but it doesn't run out because God provides for the widow, God provides for the fatherless. And this is the God that Elijah and Elisha both serve. And this is followed by another woman and Elisha's encounter with her, a woman from Shunem. She's a prominent woman. And she often prevailed upon him to stop at her place, and she would take care of him, feed him. And she says, verse 9, "I perceive that this is a holy man of God, passing by us continually. Let's make a walled upper chamber. Let us set a bed for him there, a table, chair, and a stand. And so when he comes by, well, he can stay here." And so that's what they do. And so Elisha's like, "Well, what can we do for this woman?" And so he consults, with Gehazi. Says, "We'll call this Shunammite woman," and called her. And he says, "Now say to her, 'Behold, you have been careful for us with all this care. What can I do for you? Would you be spoken for to the king or the captain of the army?'" I'm well connected. And in fact, he is going to speak to the king on her behalf in chapter 8 when she goes away because of famine when she comes back, her property's been confiscated, and the king restores it to her. But here, Jesus says, I live among my own people. I don't really have much use for that. So he said, what then is to be done for her? Gehazi said, she has no son, and her husband is old. Now this is a familiar story. Older couple, no children, been barren apparently for some time, want to get a special child that they wouldn't normally have, and then this child's going to face some kind of danger. They'll actually be taken away. So by this time next year, you will have a son. And she's like, no, my Lord, O man of God, you're not lying to your maidservant. You're pulling my leg, right? And the woman conceived and bore a son, as Elisha said. Now when the child was grown, the day came, he went out to his father, to the reapers. He said, my head, my head. And the father said, carry it to his mother. Well, he dies, of course. And we're familiar with the story, how she will not be deterred from taking her case to Elisha. She will settle for nothing less, speaking to him directly. She doesn't seem to say anything to her husband, just hightails it for Elisha. And she said, well, Gehazi, of course, tries to kind of push her away, kind of like the disciples of Jesus did on occasion with the people coming to Jesus. But Elisha says, leave her alone, for her soul is troubled within her, and Yahweh has hidden it from me and has not told me. Which shows that the prophets weren't just, you know, like inside information on everything. He just says the Lord chose to reveal it. And she said, did I ask for a son for my Lord? Did I not say, don't deceive me? And so he tells Gehazi to run and lay the staff of Elisha on the child and see if that works. No, it didn't work. So Elisha himself has to come. And verse 33, he entered and shut the door behind them both and prayed to Yahweh. He went and lay upon the child, put his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on his eyes, his hands on his hands, stretched himself on him, and the flesh of the child became warm. And of course, some people just think this is an ancient version of CPR, and that's all that happened, you know. But clearly he was dead and was raised from the dead. And so he returned and walked in the house back and forth, went up, stretched himself on him, and the lad sneezed seven times, and the lad opened his eyes. And he says, take up your son. And she went in, fell on his feet, bowed herself to the ground, and she took up her son and went out. And so, rather involved story here, but again, it represents Elisha, the God of Elisha, providing for God's people in distress. The Lord cares, the Lord provides, even in death, the Lord can do things. Of course, Elijah had his own death-raising story, so this seems intended to parallel the idea that what Elijah could do, Elisha can do likewise. So even though there's been a change of the guard, so to speak, it's the same Lord, and he's still working through his prophets and that kind of thing. And that's sort of the last two stories that we find here as well. So Elisha returns to Gilgal, and there's a famine, and so the prophets have made a pot of a stew of some kind. And one went out in the field to gather herbs and found a wild vine and gathered from it his lap full of wild gourds and came and sliced them into the pot of stew, didn't know where they were from. And as they poured it out for the men to eat, came about as they were eating the stew, they cried out and said, oh man of God, there's death in the pot. Now, we've all been there. even our own cooking. I'm not counting on anyone else's cooking. They're not able to eat it. And he says, bring meal, and throw it in the pot, pour it out so people may eat, there was no harm. Sounds very much like the healing of the water by using the new bowl with the salt. And again, I don't think in either case would have envisioned that the salt or the meal was the effective cleansing agent any more than the water of the Jordan River is going to wash away Naaman's leprosy in the next story. It's really the work of God in doing this. But again, it raises the question, why do you use the salt? Why not just say, the Lord pronounces this water fine, or the stew is fine? It may be, like we were saying with the harp player, something that may add a little extra reassurance to people if there's an object lesson or something that might give them more buy-in to the taking care of the situation. And then the chapter ends with a story that's going to sound very familiar to us. A guy comes and brings the first fruits of offering, which, of course, in northern Israel, where you're going to bring the first fruits because of the corrupt sacrificial system up there and so on. And he's got these 20 loaves of barley and fresh ears of grain, and he said, give them to the people that they may eat, and his attendant, now whether this is Gehazi, the servant's not named here, what? Shall I set this before 100 men? That's not enough bread to feed 100 men. At minimum, half a loaf would feed one person for a day. Not very comfortably, but it's doable. So, 40 people maximum that you could actually feed minimally with this. And he says, they shall eat and have some left over. And so he said it before them, they ate and had some left over according to the word of God. And so, of course, we're familiar with the story of how Jesus takes 5 loaves, you know, 1/4 as many loaves, and feeds, you know, 50 times the people instead of just 100 men. So it shows the power of Elisha, but greatly exceeded in the case of Jesus. But again, God cares, God provides, God takes care of his people. That's kind of a consistent lesson we find through all of these stories with Elisha. And it's the same as it had been before with Elijah, of course. Final comments on
that. Between this and the oil at the beginning of the chapter, it seems like Elijah's miracle, Zarephath, is kind of been split and surrounds the other two. Just now struck me, so I haven't thought about it.
Right.
But
yeah, well, the widow had the oil and the grain that never ran out, and we had the oil and we were in abundance of the bread.
And we got the resurrection of the child.
Right. Certainly a lot of connections. Yeah. So. All right, well, we'll look at the story of Naaman. Next week, basically, I think chapters 5 and 6, if I can remember correctly. Okay.